On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about the next big thing in the cloud, plus a new cybersecurity toolkit coming from the Global Cyber Alliance and MasterCard. Plus, Curtis, Brian, and I talk with Trend Micro's VP of Cloud Research on containers and their vulnerabilities. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 330, recorded February 22nd, 2019. Trend Micro talks container vulnerabilities. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. And by Thousand Eyes. Companies that run in the cloud rely on Thousand Eyes. It's the place they go first to see, understand, and improve the digital experience of their cloud-based applications and services. Do the cloud right and improve services for your customers and employees today. Visit ThousandEyes.com/twit. And by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at LinkedIn.com/this week and get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host today, Louis Marest, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the brains of this outfit, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, has your meetup timing surpassed 48 seconds yet?
I think I'm down to about 18 seconds if I see everyone who's invited me. It's funny. It gets closer and the invitations just keep piling in. I think I received somewhere around 30 today. So still trying to figure it out, see just how many breakfasts I can eat. And we may get to plumb the question of just how many cups of coffee can Kurt drink in a day with all the folks who want to meet me for coffee at RSA. So it's looking like a good conference. Can't wait to be there. But until then, can't wait to spend some time here on Twyatt.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, what better way to spend some time on Twyatt with Mr. Brian Chee, Director, Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, the geek in paradise himself. Cheebert, what's cooking down there in paradise?
Actually, we're making arrangements to have a digging party at Lions Arboretum, where a whole bunch of field ecologists and I are going to go in and we're going to dig a trench and drop in some direct bury coaxial cable so that we can get communications into a study area in amongst the trees, because we all know RF gets absorbed by water and trees have lots of water in them. So it ought to be interesting. I actually found a set of coax transceivers. You provide 57 volts in at the source, and up to 1600 feet later, I can pull out full PoE power to run an access point, a switch, or what have you, even a tilt pan zoom camera. So it's going to be really interesting to be able to finally get high-speed communications into some hard-to-get study areas.
Fantastic. You get all the fun toys, all the fun toys. Well, folks, we have quite the show for you today. Not only we're talking a little bit about the cybersecurity toolkit, but we also get into what's next in the cloud. Plus, I'm really excited about today's guest. We have Mark Nudikonovan, who's from Trend Micro, who's going to actually take us through the container landscape and vulnerabilities that exist there. Plus, he might also help us through a chant as well, where it's security is everyone's responsibility. Come on. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and first jump into this week's blips. Now, here on Twyatt, we like to keep up on the latest cybersecurity and malware that's out there in the wild, but what we don't hear a lot about is ransomware. Ransomware and actually ransomware targeting embedded systems. Well, that's what this latest ransomware is doing. It's rearing its ugly head, and it's called Cryptor, and it's targeting NAS devices, a network or network attached storage devices that are open to the internet. Now, Cryptor is new on the market, but it looks like it's planning to stay a long time. It's built for Linux systems with a focus on embedded devices, but it can be adapted to Windows too, according to its maker. Now, as NAS technology changes quickly, some manufacturers are known to tombstone their devices and stop providing firmware updates to them, which is normally security updates as well. Now, this happens to a ton of devices, including routers and other appliances, but when the device stores your private data like a NAS, it becomes even more critical for those updates. Now, this is exactly what has happened with the D-Link line of NAS devices, including the D-Link DNS 320 device. The last time its firmware was updated was back in 2016. Now, even though it's actually supported on the D-Link pages, it hasn't been updated for a long time. Now, unfortunately, this particular device has had a history of security vulnerabilities, including a bug that led to remote code execution where hard-coded backdoor was actually introduced. Now, how does CryptArch's malware get on the device? Well, malware drops two plain text files on the device using that remote execution exploit. One is a ransom note called out by the name files encrypted readme.txt. The other is actually a CryptArch support file, a CryptArch.txt. Cryptor support.txt file, which stores the address of a website on the Tor network, which enables a remote shell on an infected device if it's online. Now, once the files are encrypted, keys for unlocking the files are sold via Open Bazaar Marketplace for about $1,200 at the current Bitcoin price. Now, this is also an option to pay less for an individual file to be decrypted. The cost is around $19.99, and you have to send the encrypted file to them to get it decrypted. Now, in fact, a recent update to Open Bazaar's store page shows that the operator of the ransomware also offers a decryption key for Sinolocker for the same price. Now, this ransom strain did serious damage back in 2014 when it infected a NAS server from Synology that ran outdated versions of Disk Station Manager containing two vulnerabilities. Now, the end game here is really just to make money, which is why this ransomware is targeting small business devices like these NAS devices. Now, if your organization has one and its firmware is old and there's no update in sight, it might be time to upgrade.
Hey, remember the old Star Trek episodes where the Federation ships would rapidly modulate the frequency of their phasers in order to get past the deflector shields of, well, whatever big bad civilization they were fighting that week? A malware author was apparently watching and taking notes, because a new email Trojan campaign spotted by security researchers is rapidly randomizing the email content characteristics of their lures. Researchers with Great Horn report that the waves of attacks they've observed since earlier this week is sophisticated in that it lacks the consistency of a typical volumetric attack, making it more challenging for email security tools to identify and block. Attackers have long leaned on metamorphic and polymorphic malware techniques to make swift changes to the code in order to evade detection, so it was only a matter of time before they started taking that philosophy to the scam delivery vehicles. These attacks are switching up subject lines, email content, email addresses, display name spoofs, and destination URLs. And while the subject lines vary, they all seem to cluster around references to receipts or invoices. Now, the bulk of the compromise accounts are coming from South American companies, and take note, paid invoice attacks like these are increasingly at the top of phishers' playbooks. Last year, 6 in 10 phishing messages used some variation of invoice as its subject.
You know, in a blog post this last week, Google's parent company, Alphabet, their CEO, Sundar Pichai, said that after spending $9 billion in 2018 on data center and office construction, the company will up the ante in 2019 to $13 billion. 2019 marks the second year in a row we'll be growing faster outside of the Bay Area than in it, he said, adding that the construction will result in major expansions for the company in 14 states. Pichai said that 10,000 new construction jobs will be created in Nebraska, Nevada, Ohio, Texas, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Virginia, and that when the new facilities open the doors, tens of thousands of new employees will be added to Google's permanent payroll. By the time the dust settles at the end of the year, Google will have a physical presence in 24 states, including data centers in 13 communities. The company will build new data centers in Nebraska, Nevada, Ohio, and Texas while expanding existing locations in Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Ashburn, Virginia as part of its major internet infrastructure expansion in 2019. The bottom line is that Google and others are expanding their cloud backend with promises of new services appearing that they might very well be some amazing new AI toys showing up in the near future.
Now, if there was ever a good hacker group named Dark Overlord, is it. Now, to understand their evil, it was reported back in 2018 that they had stolen files related to the 9/11 attacks and uploaded a selection of them online. Now, what's their motivation, you may ask? Well, extortion, of course. Now, they steal information, approach media outlets with the files, and extort the group they stole the data from. Now, the initial release was only some of the data to tease the firm it stole it from, that they had more. Now, this past week, they are at it again. And now they're now offering an encryption key for the third layer of stolen material, which appears to contain thousands of emails, at least some of which are between different law firms. Now, the newly decrypted folder contains around 5 gigabytes of material, including over 8,000 apparent emails. Now, after the publication of the initial data dump back in 2018, the Dark Overlord encouraged others to crowdsource funds so the group would release more files. They published another cache in early January after raising 3 Bitcoin, or around $11,000. Now, the source of the data included firms as Hiscox Syndicates Limited, Lloyds of London, and Silverstein Properties. Now, Hiscox Group has admitted that one of their firm's networks was compromised, but little to no details around the data breach has been made public. Now, this is really something out of a movie. It's kind of terrifying to think that law firms who have tons of private information about clients are now being targeted. It's really only a matter of time where this impacts us all.
Well, and to follow on from that, are you looking for a new career? You might be in luck, because cyber extortionists can earn $36,000 a year. Cybercriminals seeking sensitive data on high net worth individuals will pay aspiring extortionists an average of $360,000 a year to target executives, lawyers, doctors, and other prominent figures. That's according to the Digital Shadows Photon research team, who this week published A Tale of Epic Extortions, a deep dive into the ways cybercriminals prey on individuals' online exposure. It wasn't long ago when online extortion meant blackmailers composing threatening emails to threaten victims with exposure of their personal data. Some warned their targets of a potential cyber attack, for example, a DDoS attempt, if demands were ignored. Ransomware emerged in the 2010s, bringing a valuable means of coercion and culminating in WannaCry in 2017. But today's extortionists are getting creative and finding new ways to earn cash. They're after details of victims' personal lives and/or sensitive corporate data. Sextortion scams, in which criminals claim to have evidence of targets watching sexually explicit content, have skyrocketed. I know, because I get several of these a day. Between July 2018 and February 2019, Digital Shadows collected and analyzed 792,000 sextortion attempts targeting 89,000 recipients. Many cybercriminals are looking for members to collaborate with so they can grow their operations. There are many ways to jump into the game, and you don't have to be technically savvy. Aspiring extortionists with weak skill sets can find tutorials on the dark web. Some experienced attackers sell DOS and ransomware as a service models to novice hackers, and researchers found message boards and forums where experts are willing to pay new recruits $30,000 or more for cyber extortion scams targeting high net worth individuals. Those with network management, pen testing, and programming skills are in higher demand and can earn $64,000 per month with add-ons and a final salary of $90,000 a month after their second year. Oh, and recruits who can speak Chinese, Arabic, or German will find themselves getting a nice 5% bump on those salaries.
You know, for the last several years, a lot of companies have been trying to fit through a very narrow door, and that door is streaming. The success of Netflix and podcast stars like Marc Maron have caused a heart attack in the entertainment world. Suddenly, everyone and every company is aiming for a taste of this action. They can't all have it. There aren't enough hours in a day to listen to a fraction of the podcasts available now. I have a half dozen on my phone. This is the author speaking. And he can't get to all of them. Long-haul truckers can get to a lot. And people who work as security guards may listen to as much as 8 hours a day. But a single Joe Rogan podcast can run 4 hours. Marin does 3 hours every week. CBS, NPR, and BBC and others are hitching their wagon to podcasts. Spotify plans to spend $500 million on podcasts, an industry that generates $700 million in revenue each year, and these numbers just don't make a ton of sense. Well, the reality is the podcasting bubble is nothing compared to the streaming bubble. Netflix has gone through the door through several huge budgets, winning not just the power to control its pricing, currently $13 a month in the U.S., but to win a global market, $130 million, most outside the U.S., through a global network system of clouds and communications infrastructure makes this all profitable. Just goes to show, everybody wants a piece of this streaming pie.
Now, have you ever thought if it was possible if machines and AI can collaborate and communicate together? Well, to teach AI to communicate, researchers have turned to card games. Now, you probably know of or played card games that require some type of collaboration or communication or even some body language to play well. Well, while AI long ago has already beat humans at chess, Go, some forms of poker, and many video games, but the games of Bridge and Hennepin offer special challenges to AI. Players must cooperate without a clear way to share information. So it's just saying, hey, I have go ahead and play this card. Now, researchers working on both games have recently developed AIs that invent their own implicit codes to coordinate their moves. Now, in the game of Bridge, there are four players and two teams, and before the game can start, players have to take turns bidding whether the team can win a trick based on the trump card set. Now, this is a strategy, but it also requires communication and collaboration as well. Now, researchers from the University College of London are trying to teach AI to play Bridge using their system called Policy Belief Iteration, now PBIT. Now, each AI player has two neural networks. One network learns to infer the partner's hand based on what's being bid. The other one learns to make appropriate bids based on the partner's inferred hand and the player's own hand. Now, during training, AI players are rewarded by making bids that improve the accuracy of their partner's inferences about the AI player's own hand. After 1.5 million practice hands, the AI pair had developed conventions of its own. For instance, bidding three of a suit as well as to signal the six of a suit might be an ideal contract. Now, the players beat other AI players that didn't use communication or model their partner's beliefs. A newer card game called Hennepin poses similar challenges of communication. In this cooperative solitaire-like game, two or five players each hold four or five cards, each with a color and a number, and take turns placing them on a colored pile in the correct order. Now, but they can't see their own cards. They actually only use the cards of their partners. They need to give the cards to other players, or they at least hint at them. Now, the context clues, both implicit and explicit in nature, assist in the part of the game. Now, DeepMind Technologies and University of Oxford have developed a machine learning system for the two-player version of Hennepin. Their Bayesian action decoder, BAD, uses neural networks and has each AI player trying to infer the beliefs of its partner. Now, who knew that your favorite card games could teach our AI overlords how to better communicate? Sooner or later, they might just trump us all. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Atlassian. Now, whether you are on an engineering team or that develops software or other products, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. I definitely have. Now, I remember back in 2002, Atlassian launched a product that was really perfectly timed, if you think about it, to meet the needs of emerging generation, which were developers committed to agile principles. Well, now, originally, it was conceived as a bug tracking tool that Jira Ticket quickly became the digital record of choice for tracking units of work and really a highly collaborative agile development area. Now, fast forward 16 years, DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps the team rise to that occasion. Now, Atlassian really is a collaboration software company that empowers teams around the world. Like all organizations, you want to ship products faster and faster, more efficiently, with higher quality, and you want to ensure customer feedback loops add to the business value. Well, sometimes businesses fall short because they don't have the workflows to do that. Well, just like anybody doing those types of things, over the last 16 years, Atlassian has really became really great in this area. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaborations. Plus, their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all sizes, from DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops to ITSM, and whatever's next. Atlassian provides a technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that propels your business. Now, with Jira Software, Confluence, and Bitbucket, Atlassian forms the backbone of an effective cross-team product planning organization and communication. With Jira Ops, Opsgenie, and StatusPage, they may help your organization be better at detecting incidents, alert response teams, coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster, and keep customers or stakeholders up to date. And it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence, and which keeps your team from bouncing around from platform to platform. I use Bitbucket as a repository for a lot of my projects. They have features that some of the other organizations don't have. If you haven't already, go check them out right now. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com/IT to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. And we thank Atlassian for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. Now, we have a couple good ones this week. Now, here in Twilight, we've had our predictions episode where we called out things like the rise of AI in manufacturing or autonomous vehicles and more. But based on the latest trends, Stephen Nichols thinks he might have the top five upcoming cloud developments coming up this year. Now, let's go ahead and go through a couple of them, and then I want to get the co-host's thoughts on this. Now, number one, he says, hey, hybrid clouds are about to take off. Why? Well, for a long time, it's kind of been a nightmare and the market has finally been hitting a critical mass that the industry is starting to do something about it. Now, Kubernetes might be the key here, because with Kubernetes, it's possible to run clusters of containers across clouds. This means you can run on your private cloud as well as on AWS or Microsoft Azure or Google Cloud. Now, number two, the rise of a service mesh. Now, service mesh is another reason for the growth of hybrid clouds. Now, these hybrid cloud containerized applications need to actually network over several different cloud architectures. Now, there's actually a vendor here that's doing really well, Istio, which is actually one of the larger players. They offer network microservices and containers while also providing discovery, failure recovery, load balancing, metrics, and monitoring services. Number two. Now, number three, we've talked about this many times, about serverless, how it basically gets the infrastructure out of the picture and there's no longer impedance there. This provides the developer with a really easy abstraction to access computer resources. Now, we also, number four, want to talk about managed cloud security. We've talked a lot about this before. There's been a ton of upswing of managed security service providers, or MSSPs. Now, they're actually becoming a really popular business. Now, since there's no all one size fits all, a lot of these MSSPs are really helping organizations be elastic in their security efforts. Of course, number five, cloud provider consolidation. Now, this is, consolidation. Now, cloud providers are acquiring each other left and right. Could it be that the big players are left standing here? I want to find out from my co-host. First, I want to throw these over to you guys. I want to get your thoughts on this. We have a large list of cloud providers, cloud service providers today. You know, who's going to be left over? What's going to be the last man standing, as you could say here? Kurt, I want to throw this over to you first. Is there going to be just a set three, set four, set five, or are they going to all just consolidate onto one?
I certainly don't think it's going to consolidate to one, and I don't think it's going to be just three, four, five. What I do think you're going to have are a handful of very large players, probably international players. Mm-hmm. And then an awful lot of small players, where I think the sort of clearing out will come is in that mid-tier, because those are the companies that have enough equipment and, importantly, enough of a customer base to make them a desirable target for those large cloud providers. And yet, they're too big to be what we're going to call a local provider. I think it's so easy to get into the cloud service business that there are always going to be small players. There are always going to be people who are starting up and serving either a limited number of business categories or a limited geographic area, in the same way that though we have some very large electrical utilities, we still have a whole bunch of electric co-ops here in the U.S. So that's what I see. Like I said, I agree that there's going to be some consolidation, but I think that this is an area where the small players hang in for a long, long time.
Makes sense. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you, because I know that you talk to a lot of organizations that are trying to use these managed cloud security providers out there. Is it really helping organizations do better security, or is it just something they're paying extra for?
It's all a matter of where you're going to spend your money. Do you have more money for HR, or do you have more money for contracting? Six one, half a dozen the other, you're going to have to pay for it. You're going to have to pay attention to security. It's just a matter of internal or external. It all depends on how your bean counters want to play that game. Now, I am going to say one thing about predictions. When Kurt and I wrote our first book on cloud computing technologies and strategies of the ubiquitous data center, these predictions in this article are actually very much what we were predicting. And one of the things that I predicted was the model that people like, you know, science fiction writers have been predicting for a long time, where computing, cloud computing, they didn't call it that, but truth be told, it's cloud computing in one form or another, was almost as ubiquitous as a utility. And that if you wanted to run something, say like, one example had a doctor for some reason needed to calculate orbital trajectories. He just went and bought some time on the net and did the calculations so that he could get his orbital ambulance to the disaster in the nick of time to save the day. You know, okay, science fiction, lots of fun. But all five of these are actually looking like stepping stones towards computing becoming more and more ubiquitous, because when I talk to lots and lots and lots of people in government, military, private sector, and so forth, the bottom line is they don't care. They just want to be able to do their job. And I think that's where we're heading. I think we're going to start seeing the cloud changing to becoming more of a I don't care what platform it is. So I think the serverless is going to be kind of an umbrella, and there's going to be a bunch of different things that are happening. Cloud security is going to have to be there. A lot of the players are probably going to merge and split and do different things, but the services are going to be moving in a direction that I think you can actually shop things around. So if you needed to do payroll, you could just move your payroll around between different cloud providers. Going to get interesting. And sadly, I think some of the small players are going to go away. The big players are going to start taking over. But there's always going to be some niche for everybody. So it's going. I think by the time I'm old and gray, or old and grayer, the computing industry is going to be starting to look more like a utility. And that's my prediction for today.
Very nice, very nice. So I think you're right. I think we're starting to see some of the players out there, once they don't have really a viable business anymore, they don't have enough people actually using their service to actually make the business viable, they just walk away. They walk away and they pivot and they do other things. And there have been many examples of this even over the last year. So it should be interesting to see how we move forward. Kurt, I wanted to throw it over to you one more question before we moved on to yours. One thing that I find interesting is there's a lot of talk about serverless. Like, I think obviously, you know, as Amazon's Lambda services, Azure Functions, a lot of different services offer this capability for you to build these like little snippets, microservices of applications. You don't have to worry about the architecture or the infrastructure. You kind of just throw it up there. They handle all the scale and the security for it and so on. But again, a lot of times they're not for everybody. We've had several guests come on saying, hey, this type of architecture is not really for everybody. Sometimes organizations grow out of it and they move more towards things like containers and so on and so forth. Do you think that this is actually a good prediction? Number three, the serverless next gen apps. I kind of think that that's almost in their rearview mirror now already. What do you think?
Well, I think that there are particular functions, particular apps, particular pieces of computing where serverless makes perfect sense. As you say, you have little bitty bits and pieces of functionality that you want to bind together into an application. Well, maybe some of those bits and pieces can come out of a serverless environment, but there are limits on those. You can't do everything serverless. You know, let's be realistic. You're never going to do a serverless OLTP database. You're never going to roll up your quarterly reports in a serverless environment. So, yeah, I think that there are places for serverless. And to be honest, I can imagine that being one of the areas where these small I called them local service providers, hang in there, because it's easier to be a serverless provider when you've got a collection of servers in a shipping container and you're just selling a function to the world. So will it be a piece of what we see? Yeah. Will it be all or even the majority of what computing becomes? Color me skeptical.
Right. Okay, well, let's move on, because I really do want to hear about this cybersecurity toolkit. So go ahead and take it away, Kurt.
All righty. So this week, I had a chance to sit down with folks from a couple of companies. Well, a couple of organizations is more correct. MasterCard and the Global Cyber Alliance. Now, you may have run into the Global Cyber Alliance through their promotion of DNSSEC and Quad9, the DNS server that they provide on a free basis. But they've gotten together, MasterCard, GCA, and they have the support of about half a dozen other companies to create the toolkit, specifically a new initiative called the Cybersecurity Toolkit, which is designed to bridge the gulf between the cybersecurity concerns that small and mid-sized businesses have and the capabilities they tend to have to address those concerns. The toolkit is designed to give small business owners basic, usable security controls and guidance. Now, the MasterCard representative said that there it's not like there's no information out there. It's not like there are no services out there. It's just that they tend not to be couched, pardon me, in terms and in ways that are highly usable by small businesses. One of the things that defines a small business is that it has a staff of IT generalists rather than security specialists. And so one or a small number of these IT generalists have to provide the cybersecurity for the organization. What the cybersecurity toolkit is designed to do is provide a cookbook for them, very actionable information in small, understandable chunks that they can use to build a realistic and, you know, a workable cybersecurity infrastructure. Now, the reason that they did this is pretty simple. According to MasterCard, globally, small businesses are a huge part of the total economy. And they feel like protecting those businesses is important for maintaining the economic benefits as the economy grows. So what's in this cybersecurity toolkit? There are three huge sections. One is filled with operational tools that help companies take inventory of their cyber-related assets, create and maintain strong passwords, use multi-factor authentication, perform backups, things like that. The second is how-to materials. So you get templates for policies, forms for keeping track of those policies, training videos, and other foundation documents. The third, they bring in recognized best practices from leading organizations in the industry. These include the Center for Internet Security Controls, the UK's National Cybersecurity Center Cyber Essentials, the Australian Cybersecurity Center's Essential 8, and MasterCard. Now, they have some fairly ambitious goals for the toolkit. Phil Reitinger, the president and CEO of GCA, says that they intend to reach 1 million businesses in 1,000 days. As for how the businesses should use the information, he says he wants to make it so simple that a family dry cleaner with mom, dad, and 2 kids can do what they need to do for cybersecurity. So I'm going to bring my co-host in and ask you, and Brian, I'm going to start with you. How important do you think it is to protect the assets of small businesses? I mean, is this something that is really too small to be cared about?
Oh, no, I think this is actually more important because small businesses can't afford to have specialists. Most of the time, a small business can only borrow an IT specialist through some sort of contractor. So as we start having tools that normal people can use, you know, I talk to a lot of my friends. You know, I love Snubs and those guys over at Hack 5. I love that they have the time to go and do pen testing and do all these really cool things. But, you know, the normal person just doesn't have the time to eat the learning curve on these tools. And having easier to use tools are going to make a huge difference. And just seeing how much of an economy is made up of small businesses, I personally think this is about time and past due.
You know, I tend to agree with you because I come out of the small business world. Now, Lou, the kind of products that you direct the programming on are used by businesses of all sizes as well as individual consumers. So when you think about security, how simple are they going to have to make it? How much of an expert are these people in the small businesses going to have to become if they're going to be able to do something meaningful about security?
I think that's a great question. I think that the problem with security is there's different levels of complexity that go along with them depending on the different sector of business that you're in. So if you're in a law firm, sometimes you have to have, you know, enterprise-related security around the document where people can only read it, they can't print it, they can't copy it, they can't edit it, you know, versus, you know, if you're in a place where, you know, you provide services and you want to have everyone access the same invoice on a server, that kind of thing. It's really kind of interesting, depending on the industry that you're in, will change the shape of what your security needs to be. So when you say, am I going to have a specialist in my area? I mean, sometimes you definitely do, especially for the area that you're in. So I don't think there's, again, we've talked about this many times, there's really no one size fits all for security. So the toolkit might be a good start, but I'm sure that there's going to be quite a bit of noise that's going to go on there when it comes, depending on the industry that you're in. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, we have a really great guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Thousand Eyes. Now, you ever watch one of those sci-fi movies where they show you the room with all the tons of screens on the wall about data on their network? Well, wouldn't it be cool if that could be a reality? Imagine if you had a thousand eyes. You already know that the internet is the backbone of organizations, enterprises. It's a complex network of nodes and data. And when your business depends on it, you need to have deep insights into the health and performance of it all at all times. Now, Thousand Eyes is going to make it easier for you and your organization to do so. Now, nowadays, with tons of cloud apps, PaaS, and SaaS services like Office 365, WebEx, Salesforce, and more, you have to have a view or a lay of the land of the network and the internet at all times. You need to know how it could or is affecting your customers' experiences. Well, it's in the company name. They give you more than 1,000 eyes to surface that data you need to provide best-in-class service and a view of your network. Now, you might say, well, it's got to be hard to set up if I'm going to be doing all of that. And it's going to be hard to deploy as well. Well, Thousand Eyes has found a way to make it easy to deploy and get started collecting data in no time. They have a concept of network agents. You deploy these agents throughout your network, and you're instantly able to visualize and monitor and diagnose your networks. Whether you deploy on a virtual appliance, a Hyper-V appliance, or others, they make it really easy to start getting valuable information about the networks that it can affect your business. Now, these agents are sensors that are deployed globally and give a pulse of data of what's going on the network. Now, imagine if you have a user or a customer complaining about their access to Office 365 or some other service all the way over in Japan. Well, your cloud agent in Japan can give you data you need to diagnose what's going on the network and causing the issue. Now, global sets of customers are not a problem with Thousand Eyes. They give you a vantage point of the network and the way you need to diagnose and solve the problem. They also have a concept of enterprise agents, which work their way inside the enterprise. Whether they're at a branch office or data center, they can give you really a hybrid and end-to-end view of the entire network. I know, having used the power of Thousand Eyes, it makes you feel like you are in the driver's seat of your network and services, and they make it easy for you to follow too. Now, Thousand Eyes also puts themselves in the point of view of your customers and your end users with their endpoint engines. They actually can get the view of your customers and what they're actually seeing as well. Now, all that data is collected and aggregated over time, processed, correlated for patterns across all the agents and data sets. It truly is network intelligence. They put themselves in the brain, the eyes of the network engineer, IT professional as well. You can probably envision your network looking a certain way with interconnected nodes. You can't really troubleshoot your network actually by looking at charts, bar charts, line graphs, and stuff like that. You actually need a spatial view of that network. And well, that's where Thousand Eyes provides a really beautiful real world set of visualizations that really encapsulate that complexity of that network. And they give you the data you need to run it proactively and reactively. Now, there's no more Wireshark to try and figure out the issues. Your networks are more than just the MPLS backbone networks. You need more than a package that captures net flows. Now, Thousand Eyes helps you solve real world issues with unique, actionable data and great visualizations. Regain control of your network and ensure the best possible experience for your customers and employees. Get an immediate, unmatched view of all the networks and dependencies that impact your users' digital experience. Visit thousandeyes.com/twit to see what you've been missing. You'll get the exclusive ebook on the 5 cloud migration challenges you shouldn't ignore. If the cloud is important to you, either today or in the future, visit thousandeyes.com/twit. thousandeyes.com/twit. Thousand Eyes, thrive in a connected world. And we thank Thousand Eyes for their support this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it brings to my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today is no exception. We have Mark Nunakovin from Trend Micro, who is the VP of Cloud Research. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, our audiences kind of love hearing origin stories and people's journey to tech. Can you maybe take us through a brief journey for you and how you kind of got started and how you get it end up at Trend Micro?
Sure. I started really young, programming computers. I was really excited. First one was a Commodore 128. Started to see, what was possible. And that always stuck with me. And I started my IT journey actually in development and in development and test and very quickly in research. I started out actually building out TV set-top boxes that are super common now, but were, first of their kind way back when. And that sort of curiosity of how things worked has kind of naturally led me into security over time. I spent a decade with the Canadian federal government, doing things and stuff. And then I've been with Trend Micro for the last 7 years, focusing on helping people understand the cloud and move into the cloud. So I've been able to use, a lot of my skills that I've developed over the years. I spent a number of years in forensic investigations. That's actually where my education lies. It's given me a solid background to understand where people are going or where they're coming from and where they're going.
Fantastic. Now, there's always tons to talk about when it comes to security, especially cloud security. And you mentioned a little bit about serverless. I'm sure there's plenty of topics there. But what we want to focus on today, we're talking a little bit more about containers. Now, maybe mm-hmm. you can give us just a lay of the land around containers and like how things are, what's the security landscape of them today?
Sure. I think it's important with containers to understand why we have them. And they're really good at what they were designed for, and that is to solve the packaging problem. If you've ever written an application, have ever deployed one into production, I guarantee you've had this argument with someone where you say, it works on my machine. Because it doesn't work in your environment, it worked on mine. And containers are designed to solve that problem. They're a way of basically packaging everything up so that if it worked on your machine, it's going to work in your data center, it's going to work in the cloud, it's going to work wherever you run that container. And they do that really, really well. But from a security perspective, the first thing that should sort of, start your tinfoil hat buzzing is that they operate in a loosely isolated environment, sharing the kernel of the operating system that they're running on. So as a security guy, anytime I hear the word loosely isolated, that's right. No isolation, right? It might as well not be there. So there's some security challenges because you're running separately packaged things in a very much shared environment. And that was an environment designed for developer efficiency. It wasn't necessarily designed for security from the ground up.
Got it. Yeah. So I think that's the interesting thing. Now you've obviously been on Trend Micro for a while. Now, how long has Trend Micro been to kind of exploring security and around container vulnerabilities?
Container vulnerabilities, we've followed right from the start. So we jumped in the cloud really early on. We've been a major partner for the cloud providers for the last 7 or 8 years. We've been working with containers internally for a really long time. We've got a massive amount of researchers around the world. We've got about 1,200 researchers globally. So we look at everything. And as a big development shop ourselves, knowing that containers, you know, they solve that real problem, we've been looking at them for the last, aggressively for the last 3 years. And, you know, in bits and bytes before that.
Makes sense. Now, we know that there's like unlimited ways and creative ways attackers can exploit vulnerabilities. What kinds of vectors, attack vectors are that maybe our viewers should be aware of that containers have? I know you talked a little bit about shared resources, shared OS. And so that sounds a little circumstance there. Sounds a little suspect.
Yeah. And we actually saw that last week with a new CVE. It was 5736, which is calling out an issue with RunC, which is the container runtime. So this is the application that sits on your host that's going to run your containers. And it was a pretty easily to exploit vulnerability where you could actually escape from the container and overwrite that RunC file so you could potentially infect the host. So we have that constant concern of, you know, is that container a threat to the other containers, let alone to itself? We see attackers going after that. We see attackers going after registries as well. So it's very common in a container development workflow for you to either use a public or a private registry of essentially approved containers. And we're seeing a few people trying to insert malicious containers in there. So containers that are running crypto mining malware or just basically scanners trying to discover what assets they're being deployed next to. So those are the big pushes we're seeing that are unique to containers because they're giving the attackers a foothold. And that's really what they're always after is, you know, if I can exploit one thing, what else is around it that I can also start to exploit and see what's on the customer or the victim's network?
Now, the interesting thing, I noticed that you said, hey, like, they exploit other things. Now, how can an organization really protect itself here? I mean, you talked a little bit about already a vulnerability that's been found. But if they've already kind of exposed other things, maybe they haven't used those being able to expose them just yet. How can an organization protect itself from those types of things?
Yeah. So as with anything, you know, it's always defense in depth. You're not going to just look at one thing. And when it comes to containers, there's a lot of depth to try to defend. And you want to start with the container host. So if you're running your own infrastructure, and we're seeing this really in hybrid cloud scenarios where people are trying to maximize their current investment on premise, and it makes it easier to transition into the cloud as if they convert everything over to containers. Well, if you're running the host, you need to lock that down. The good news here is that if that server is running containers, it has a really limited set of things that it should be running. So it's going to be running the container host. It's going to be running a log management tools, and you should have some security controls on there. You're going to need to look at traffic between containers as well as north-south out of the enterprise. So good news, again, you know, north-south's pretty well understood. East to west within containers is a little bit trickier because it's very much, you know, overlay network. It's a lot of service discovery and mesh topologies there. You know, you're looking earlier in the build chain as well. So how are developers actually building out these containers? Because we're seeing attackers move earlier and earlier in the development lifecycle. Because if they can compromise the developer's laptop and then get into the source repository, anytime they're deployed in any environment, then they've got their foothold again.
Makes sense. So I think one thing I'm interested about is there's a couple vendors out there that support hypervisor systems like VMware and Hyper-V. Are you seeing, now you've kind of done this research for a while, are you seeing similar vulnerabilities in each individual one, or they have their own kind of different sets of vulnerabilities per kind of vendor?
Yeah, I think the you know, if we expand that to the virtual machine question and stuff, we see the same types of attacks going against them all. In fact, one of the hacking competitions, so the Zero Day Initiative runs Pwn to Own twice a year. They are the mobile and the main Pwn to Own, where they invite researchers in to show the latest exploits. The last couple of years, we've seen people going after VMware, going after that a virtualization layer to leverage some really small vulnerabilities in a chain to jump out out of the guest into the host, which is very similar to what we saw in the container attack last week. So there's definitely a lot of similarities because the setup's the same or very close, but the difference with a virtual machine setup and sort of Hyper-V and VMware and all that kind of thing is that there is much stronger isolation. So it's much harder to get outside the host because every guest is running their own entire OS stack. Now that's the trade-off is there's a bigger performance hit. And the advantage of containers is basically they follow, if they're done right, they follow the Unix philosophy of sort of one thing, one container that does one thing really, really well. So you see a lot more of them a lot quicker within the environment.
Now, are you also seeing this, like, for instance, are you seeing this because a lot of different systems like Kubernetes and systems and so on are more used? And so you're saying, hey, they're starting to target the ones that are more used over time?
Yeah, and that's, you know, we've seen that for the last 30 years with cyber criminals, right, is that they're out to make money. And that's the vast majority of challenges we face in cybersecurity is defending against these, you know, organized cyber criminals. And they'll go where people are using things. And that kind of goes back to, you know, if we step out of the server world, why Mac has that reputation of being more secure than Windows. It was simple economics. If Windows is running 90% of the systems where they can extract value from, you're going to invest your time if you're an attacker. So we see the same thing in the cloud world. We see the same thing in development, where now that containers are really mainstream, it's not you know, weird or out of place to see major Fortune 1000s running a lot of containers. Obviously, cyber criminals are now putting their efforts there because that's where they think they can make money.
So now that you kind of brought, you kind of let the cat out of the bag there, I wanted to see if you mentioned Linux versus Windows. I think I want to ask you, so are you seeing if the host OSs are Linux or Windows, are you seeing additional vulnerabilities that are coming from either or? Are you seeing more from one? Is there a recommendation there as well?
Yeah, so I'd rather take this fight than Vim versus Emacs, so I'm okay sure. with this line.
Okay.
You know, again, it comes down to usage. In containers, we're seeing almost exclusively against Linux workloads because that's predominantly the vast majority of containers that are deployed out there. Similarly, across cloud, we're seeing a lot more Linux-based workloads than Windows-based workloads. And of course, that changes if you're looking at like Microsoft Azure. We'll see a lot more Windows on there. But again, it really comes down to where's the money. If it's a targeted attack, it will be very specific against the OS that the target is going to be using or likely to be using. Whereas if it's a broad sweep attack, you know, we tend to see a balance across them. But with general malware, you're going to see a lot more attempts and successes against Windows, just based on volume again.
Makes sense. Well, my co-hosts are talking vigorously here in the chat room. They want to ask some questions. So when we come back after this ad, we do want to bring them in to ask some questions. But before we do that, we of course want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is LinkedIn. Now, let me ask you a question. Where are all the professionals today? You know. They're on LinkedIn. It's the world's largest professional network. 70% of the U.S. workforce is on LinkedIn. Now, some of the biggest names in the industry post content there every day. I post there jobs, interests, technology, everything. Plus, I've made some amazing professional contacts using LinkedIn. That actually goes to show you that LinkedIn can really help your business. Now, post your job where people go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover those job opportunities. It's LinkedIn. You've used other sites, but they just don't really feel right. They are clunky. They have different types of responses from not great individuals. Well, that's where LinkedIn comes in. If you think about it, there are 500 million pros on LinkedIn every day. LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity out there in front of the right people at the right time. Now, the advantage LinkedIn has, it gives you the tools to target your next generation workforce with laser precision. Most LinkedIn members aren't checking job boards regularly, but 9 out of 10 LinkedIn members are open to and interested into new job opportunities. So with most of the U.S. workforce on LinkedIn, you might want to find a better way to post your jobs, and that is on LinkedIn. They will help you out no matter what. People with the right skills and background for your role who are also ready for something new. It's the best way to find a person who will help you grow your business, and why a new hire is made every 8 seconds using LinkedIn. I've used them in the past. It's amazing how fast they can scale your talent acquisition. Hurry to LinkedIn.com/this week and get $50 off your first job post. That's LinkedIn.com/this week to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn.com LinkedIn.com/thisweek. And we thank LinkedIn for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, I'm going to jump back over here to the guest, and also I'm going to bring in my co-host in crime here, starting with Curtis. Curtis, you wanted to talk a little bit more about vulnerabilities.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about, it seems like containers are in many ways inextricably tied with DevOps. And, you know, where you have DevOps, you must have had a foundation of Agile. And there are a lot of people who still believe that this very rapid iteration, the constant change that's the hallmark of DevOps, is inherently insecure. So when you look at these vulnerabilities, you mentioned the specific CVEs, and we have murmurings of the ability to hop between containers. Do you think that there are some real issues that are joined in the container to DevOps link? Or do you think this is sort of an overblown concern from the old waterfall folks who don't want to give up?
I think it's a little bit of both. So I deal with this question all the time. So I am very much a security person, you know, sort of by training, by many hours in front of the console, hunting down threats, investigations, things like that. But I deal with the cloud all the time. And I deal with these teams. And the way I phrase DevOps to security people, because it is, you know, it kind of shakes you to your core of like, what do you mean you're going to make changes to production every hour? Like, that's crazy. It's hard to keep up, and it fights everything we assume is right in security. The way I flip it is I say, you know, look at it this way. You're making smaller changes to production more often, which means you're reducing the risk of each change. And it's far easier to manage that risk in small, tiny increments rather than that monthly, update window every Saturday night, you know, the third week of the month, we're going to do a massive update to a bunch of systems. Having this regular cadence is far better. And there was a great State of DevOps report from the folks at Dora who sort of kicked off the DevOps moment, Gene Kim and Jeb and all them, where they do this annual study, and they looked at 30,000 organizations who are along the DevOps journey. And they found that, you know, the elite of them, so 7% of these folks, were able to make changes to production with the same level of quality within an hour as a bunch of other folks. So from a security perspective, that means instead of that emergency patch to address something that throws everything out the window, you skip a whole bunch of testing steps, just to get this out there to reduce that risk. In a good DevOps culture, in a healthy DevOps culture, you can push that patch out within an hour without taking on any more risk because you're still going through your normal QA. So yes, there's some challenges because of the loose isolation in containers. There's challenges with the rapid pace. But I think if you adopt it and if you work with the teams, that's a huge security win, not actually a loss.
Okay, I can dig working with the teams. I think that's critical. But, you know, again, containers have the reputation for being great tools for the dev group. Mm-hmm. But when you get ready to deploy in a production environment, well, then it's time to go to virtual machines, you know, VMware or something like that. How do you feel about that? Is the container world one that is best suited for the technologically savvy group that is in things like dev, or is it sufficiently robust to be part of an organization's real production deployment?
I think it's robust enough at this point. A year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I probably would have given you a different answer because we were seeing, you know, minor dot revisions on the main Docker runtime that completely restructured networking. And that's unacceptable in a production environment, right? You need some level of stability. But I think this is an example of where moving into the cloud is a huge boost because you're going to push all that complexity. So running like something like Kubernetes solves a lot of problems that you've created by deploying a ton of containers, but it adds adds a huge operational burden in the infrastructure. And that's something you don't want because it's not getting you towards your goal. So if you can push that to your cloud provider and, you know, get into this stack where you can simply give your cloud provider container and it's running based on your networking, your CPU, your memory requirements, that's sort of the ideal because there is this, you know, it solves the dev problem, but it also puts a bunch of work on other people. And that's the challenge. When you talk to developers, they're all, you know, they've got out the pom-poms, it's rah, rah, rah containers because it made their lives easier. But it made their lives easier by making operational teams or infrastructure teams' lives harder. Now, in the general trend, we're seeing less and less work on those teams because people are moving into public cloud providers. But we are still in that mix where you need to evaluate it. It's not you can't just dive in assuming it's going to be all good. You need to go in eyes wide open for sure.
Makes sense. It's a good segue. Brian, you have some questions about practices.
Actually, I want Mark to get up on a soapbox and start talking about best practices, say, for container hygiene.
Ooh, yeah, I'll grab my soapbox and then, you know, my bat to make sure people listen for real. there is, you know, container hygiene is a challenging thing because developers, especially moving agilely, you know, they're really trying to solve a specific problem. So when I'm explaining security to developers, I always work around the definition of done, right? If you ask a developer to build a function that, you know, spits out a TPS report, they're going to say it's finished when that report is generated. Security me puts on my tinfoil hat and says, what else can I make that do, right? Can I make it spit out HR information, financial? How can I abuse that? So for developers, they need to expand that definition of what actually done means. And the same thing directly applies into building a container. So a container is part of their deployment step. It's a packaging step. A lot of them just assume they'll grab a container off of a public registry and start building on it. Well, you need to scan that container. You need to make sure that there are no known vulnerabilities that you haven't mitigated, that there's no malware sitting on that container. And you need to make sure that as you're developing, that you're not exposing API keys, that you're not leaving things vulnerable and open. You can't just assume that the work you're building on is good. And I think that's the number one thing around hygiene is that right now people assume if I grab a container out of the Docker public registry, that that container is locked down, it's secure, and you know it's a good foundation to build on. That could be true. It might not be. And from a security perspective, you want to make sure. So that's where tools like container image scanning will come into play. And then also remembering that core Unix philosophy, right? Your container should be doing one thing and one thing really well. It's not like a virtual machine where you have the full OS. You are in that loosely isolated environment. You are, battling for resources with other containers. So you want to make sure that you're not running additional services that you don't need to run. And essentially just hardening that container down. That's a step that a lot of people forget or don't even know they have to take in the first place. So those would be my big two.
So now that we talked a little bit about hygiene, we're running a little low on time, but I wanted to get one quick thought about this. There's a lot of talk about hybrid clouds, on-premise, private clouds. Does this really change the landscape at all? Is it the same stuff you've been talking about that they need to worry about here? Or is it different for either public, private cloud or the hybrid scenario?
It's pretty similar across them. The difference is in your data center, you're going to be running a lot of that lower level infrastructure to run the containers. So you're going to be building out the hosts that you need to protect. You're going to be running Kubernetes backplane, which is now going to be a critical service. Whereas when you're in the cloud, you can get your provider to do that. I think the biggest thing is, you know, hybrid cloud is the reality. Unless you started your company today, you have sunk cost in a bunch of assets running somewhere, whether that's in your own data center or in a colo somewhere. You want to make sure that you're going to get your value out of that. So, you know, even if you're all in on the cloud, it's a couple year transition. Containers can help make that transition easier simply by unifying the environment. If you run a container in your data center, it's the same developer and security challenges and experience that you'd be running it in the cloud. So if you go to a container, you know, primary container based environment, you can actually unify that, sort of smooth out some of that transition, because the worst case scenario for a multi-environment rollout is if you have different processes and tools for each of those environments, because now you're doubling or tripling your workload with no added benefit.
Fantastic. Mark Nudikoven, Trend Micro's VP of Cloud Research, thank you so much for being here. Maybe you could tell the folks at home where they can find you, all of your work. Maybe some information about where they can get started, understand about how to have better hygiene with containers and so on.
Yeah, Yeah, for sure. You can find me online, like it says in the lower third, on most social networks, at MarkNCA. I do vlog a couple times a week to talk about issues like containers, like security and privacy. Also, trendmicro.com/containers. We've got a ton of stuff up there around, obviously, solutions that Trends provides, but just educational information to help you get up to speed and understand what you're up against as a security pro and as a developer.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 container apps. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-hosts in crime, starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chibert. Where could the people find you, your work, and all the fancy things that you're doing during the week?
Well, I am still ADVNETLAB. And people have been asking me, why am I not Chibert on Twitter? And that's because someone else has decided to be Chibert, and apparently they grabbed it after I started this podcast. So someone's sitting on it thinking, oh, maybe they're going to get money out of me. I don't know, whatever. But anyway, ADV NetLab, Advanced NetLab, or I'm Chibert at twit.tv. Please throw show ideas at me. I'm actually also on Facebook and talking to different people. I actually had a great conversation with a whole bunch of people in the WISPA, Wireless Internet Service Provider Association, and they gave me a bunch of really great ideas for shows, and I would love to hear from you. In fact, why don't you guys use Twiit at twit.tv? That hits all the hosts.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chibert. Of course, we have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks find you in all of 8 seconds of your fancy self?
All 8 seconds. Find me on Twitter at KG4GWA. There I tend to be pointing to my work at Dark Reading. And these days, a lot of that has to do with getting ready for RSA. Hey, if you're going to be at RSA, hit me up on Twitter and let me know. I'm putting together a list of 6 questions for security professionals. Would love to ask you those questions at RSA.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys. Thank you guys for being here. I also have to thank you, of course. You're the person that keeps drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. So go ahead and go right now to twit.tv/twiit. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, co-host information, guest information, and all the links to the stories we actually do during the show as well. But more importantly, right next to that, those videos there, you'll get those really helpful download and subscribe links where you can support the show by getting your audio version of your choice, your HD video or video version of your choice. Of course, you can listen on all your different devices as well. That's the best way to get your enterprise goodness. So go ahead and subscribe and share it with your friends. Now, after you subscribe, also remember, we do the show live each and every week, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays at live.twit.tv. Come see how the show is run. Of course, you're going to jump in live. You might as well jump into the chat room as well. We get some really great content from the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Now, before I forget, it's also time for our yearly Twit survey, and I want to hear from you so we can serve you better. Head over to twit.to/survey19. And be heard. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. You'll get to see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. Also, check out dev.office.com. We post all the latest and greatest ways to customize Office. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Thank you to Leo and Lisa who continue to support us each and every week of doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. Of course, I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit. And, of course, our very own Mr. Brian Chi. He is our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and plannings for the show. We really could do this show without him. Now, before we sign out, I, of course, have to continue our tradition. Victor, our TD for today. Victor, can you just really give us a quick one word? Hey, this is what the show is about today.
What I got out of it was container hygiene is important in public and in private.
Okay. I'd say that's pretty close, but I would say that it's more about containers and that everyone's job is security, not just yours. But I'd say we'll give you a B plus for today. How about that?
All right, I'll take it.
All right, sounds good. Well, folks, until next time, I'm Louis Moresca. Just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
We'll be right back.